All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio, and I'm going to be playing for the next part of the program. I'm going to be playing a recording of a talk that was given by Ronan Lee. Ronan Lee is part of the International kind of State Crime Initiative and the author of Myanmar's Rohingya Genocide Identity, History and Hate Speech. This forum he spoke at was a panel discussion that was organised by Green Left last week on the question around repression and resistance in Myanmar. Because currently, right now, there's a very expiring kind of social movement happening in Myanmar right now against the military coup. And Rowan Lee's kind of talk gives kind of a good sort of setting up of the kind of context for the military coup and basically the kind of what's sort of happening next in response. So yeah, I hope listeners enjoy this recording as that I'm going to play in 3, 2, 1.
Well, look, thanks so much for organising this. It's good to join you. I want to just obviously mention that this is not the first event that Sue and her team have organised on this subject. One of the immense frustrations for people who've worked on subjects like the situation in Myanmar is that there are people who do great work, but whenever there's international media attention or even national media attention, you get all sorts of other people who come out of the woodwork and I think sometimes distract from important narratives and important messages. And so I'm always delighted to participate in events that are organised by groups that have actually got a long-standing history and understanding of the issues, and great to be on another panel with Habib as well. So hi Habib. I should start by mentioning that, I'll admit, I was surprised that a coup took place on the 1st of February. It was not something that was beyond the realm of possibility. And it was the prospect of a coup was something that, in fact, I'd mentioned in my book as a potential. But my feeling by the time we got to the 1st of Feb was that the military had come to terms with the situation as it existed in Myanmar. And the situation was this, that they had a constitution that they wrote in 2008 that gave them immense political and economic power. 25% of the seats in the parliament were occupied by soldiers wearing uniforms, appointed directly by the commander-in-chief of the military, Min Aung Hlaing, who was subject to zero civilian oversight of military decisions. So here's a situation where the military is, in fact, constitutionally a law unto itself. There was no oversight. The other elected representatives in the country had no means of exercising any oversight or scrutiny on the activities of the military. I mean, a perilous situation that you could imagine, even with the military whose history had until recently, if a military's history had been positive and you gave them that sort of free hand, you'd be deeply concerned about what would immediately occur. This was a military that has a history of brutal repression of the people of Myanmar, and they're granted 25% of the seats in the parliament. They're granted ministerial positions that are reserved for them in important roles, and they've got zero oversight and zero scrutiny from the elected civilian politicians. It was a pretty concerning situation for the civilians in Myanmar. And I thought, and I think most people thought, pretty good deal from the military's point of view. There was an election held last November, and again, overwhelmingly rejected the military's proxy candidates. I mean, they came home with 8% of the available seats. So of the remaining 75, a proxy party comes home with about 8% of the available seats. And that was less than they got at the 2015 election. So We're seeing that at every opportunity, the people are rejecting the military as best they can. That seems to have upset the military to a degree that I think has surprised a lot of us. It seemed to be the point where they realized that they were never going to have any more power within Myanmar than they had had in the past, and that the country was genuinely rejecting them at every opportunity. They were upset at the conduct of the election, they said, and they followed a playbook that had been laid out, in fact, by Trump. They claimed that an election undertaken during COVID times was rife with electoral fraud. They claimed that it didn't reflect the will of the people, and they blamed the elected, the representatives of the majority that were elected, and that's Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, and we can talk a bit more about her later. I don't want you to think for a moment that I think she's a positive representative of the people. She's a racist, but she and her party did represent the majority of those elected at the election in November. The military blamed her. She, though, was not minded to negotiate with them in the lead up to the members of parliament taking up their seats in early February. So there's a difference between Myanmar and Australia. They have elections in November, and the system is very much that the parliamentarians aren't regarded as parliamentarians until they've officially taken up their seats. It would be, constitutionally probably a little bit similar to Australia. There's often a lag between the election and when the parliament first sits. But in Myanmar, it's a clearly determined lag. So the new government doesn't come in. It wouldn't be expected to have come in till the parliament had sat. So for instance, in 2015, there was an election in November, but the new government didn't take up its seats till I think end of the following March or the beginning of the April of 2016. During that period, there was a crisis this time. So between November 20 and February, Suu Kyi didn't negotiate to the military satisfaction. There was some intervention, I understand, from Chinese diplomats in the week leading up to the coup in an attempt to forestall any potential coup. The military started to talk about a coup during that week. But the overwhelming feeling of most observers at the end of January was the military had a pretty good deal. They'd done as much sabre rattling as they were likely to do, and ultimately they would not want to upset the apple cart too much. We were wrong about that, and we were wrong for a number of reasons. The obvious one is that we became comfortable with the where Myanmar was at, and we didn't realise that the military hadn't changed one iota in terms of international observers. The military hasn't changed. This is the same military that genocidally attacked the Rohingya in 2017. This is the same military that's been in constant conflict with ethnic minorities in Myanmar since the 1950s. They're brutal. They're horrid. They're guilty of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. These are not my assessment. This is UN investigators assessing this. And they wanted absolute power within Myanmar. They weren't going to get that with an elected parliament that wasn't prepared to give in to them, which is what they realised they had with the outcome of November's election. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about the potential for Min Aung Hlaing, the senior general who launched the coup. He was due to retire this year. It was at the mandatory age. And it was clear that the new parliament would not pass legislation to allow him to extend his stay. And of course, he and his family have extensive business interests within Myanmar. They would be at risk were he forced to retire. And that the perception was that was another key motivator for him in particular as the head of the military pushing for a coup and ultimately launching a coup. I mean, what do the coup involve? Arresting the elected politicians. They've been incommunicado. They've been charged. Some have been charged with COVID-related offences going back to the election campaign and other things. But the nature of the charges are irrelevant because it's a military that will just, I mean, it uses the law arbitrarily. So we can sort of look beyond what someone might be charged with. Others will be charged with security offences and various things like that. But they'll simply keep those politicians in jail. They're not going to let them out because they don't want to provide a rallying point for the community. But the community has rallied, and the community's rallied in a couple of important ways. Obviously, there's those who support and are connected with the elected politicians. So the old sort of National League for Democracy folk who want a return to Aung San Suu Kyi of the civilian rule of Aung San Suu Kyi. But I think most importantly, there's a very strong civil disobedience movement in Myanmar now. There's a general strike underway. And that has pushed the demands of the protest movement beyond simply a return to the pre-coup status quo. And I think that's, for me, one of the most important things that's come out of this. Myanmar's a really young country. 70% of the country weren't born in 1988. So that's when Aung San Suu Kyi first came to political prominence during an uprising. Then 70% of the country weren't born when that occurred. And they've many of them have grown up with access to the outside world. They've grown up with they've grown up with access to the internet that their parents didn't have. They're far more internationalist. They're far more globalist. They've linked with the Milk Tea Alliance, and they've got aspirations for themselves that are simply not a return to the status quo that the National League for Democracy and Aung San Suu Kyi's government had given them. They don't want to return. They don't simply want the old 2008 constitution put back in place and the military to maintain their privileges. They want the military fully out of politics. And they've actively pursued strategies of unity with other groups in a way that the majority, the activists from the majority group, the Bamar in Myanmar, it's a Buddhist group, has in the past really not done to this extent. People have legitimately argued in the past that the dispute between the military and Aung San Suu Kyi was in fact a dispute between two elite groups within the majority ethnicity. These protests are not that. These protests are the people showing remarkable unity nationally, opposing a brutal military regime. Important, and Habib will no doubt talk about this, but there has been a reaching out to Rohingya as part of that protest movement in a way that we wouldn't have expected even 1 year ago or 6 months ago. There's now an understanding from many among the majority of the country, and not everyone. I mean, you know, this is far from wholesale change, but there is an acknowledgement by many that many of the crimes that they heard had been undertaken against the Rohingya, but frankly didn't believe because they considered them too brutal, that they thought people were play acting. They're now realizing that those things are happening on their street. They're happening in Mandalay and Yangon and Bago. So there's a reckoning going on for many in Myanmar with what has happened with the Rohingya and this silence on that, that there's an understanding that maybe the aspirations of the ethnic minority groups, basic things, they want some local autonomy, which is not unreasonable. They want their culture and language to be valued, which is not unreasonable. But there's an understanding now that those things are not markers of sedition as they were often presented by the military in the past, but they're just reasonable demands. And they've been seen as reasonable demands by many, many people in Myanmar who a year ago would have ignored them or rejected them. So that's an important change that's underway. That unity, I think, is incredibly important. where are we now, I think, is important too. Well, where we are is chaos. We've had this is week 11. The military launched the coup on the 1st of Feb. They would have expected, using their usual tactic, I mean, the military and Myanmar's usual tactics are shooting people or brutalizing people in other ways as a means of getting them to do what the military wants to do. That hasn't worked this time. And we're 11 weeks in. And what we've got is a general strike, a massive civil disobedience movement. The banks are barely functioning. When an ATM opens, there are mile-long queues to access cash, literally mile-long queues.
2 minutes to go,
Ronan. Yep, no worries. I'll finish with this. Literally mile-long queues. So the banking system is tottering. It's about to collapse. The public service isn't working. The public transport is literally at a standstill. This is a country that is simply not working. And the military are in a position now where the people have made clear that they simply won't work for them. So where that leaves the international community is that they've got the military who the people won't work for. The country can't function if the military's in control. But the military believes that they need to convince the people. And the way they intend to do that is by shooting them. And we saw that in Bago on the weekend, where they used rifle-propelled grenades against peaceful protesters, piling bodies up in pagodas, burning people alive. There's instances of that as well. There are now 756 people dead, 50 children shot in their homes. This is a brutal military, and it's not going to stop its brutality until someone stops them. The people won't work for them, and that means that Myanmar is heading very quickly towards either a situation where there is a widespread civil war, or it becomes a failed state. And that's a problem for the region and the world. From the West's point of view, Western rhetoric has been great. It's been much better than it's been under Trump when it comes to Myanmar, but that's all it's been. There's been not much more. We need a global arms embargo at a minimum. There's no excuse for the military been able to buy more bullets because they're using them against children. So at a minimum, we need a global arms embargo. We probably need the international community. In fact, we do need the international community now to recognize the alternate government, which would likely have to be the representatives of the elected politicians plus others. So the CRPH, the representatives, the elected politicians, and I'd say CRPH plus. So those reps plus ethnic minorities and others need to be included in that process. And that needs to happen immediately. And we need to see UN investigators and probably Guterres on the ground in Myanmar. They need to go there. I mean, enough of the excuses. We don't need another nice statement from Guterres. We don't need anything more from Biden. We need them to go there. And I'll leave it there.